From KRCC in Colorado Springs, this is Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray.
I'm Steve Hayward.
And this week we have a special edition recorded at the Richard Celeste Theater at the Cornerstone Arts Center on the Colorado College campus.
We performed the show live for a studio audience as part of Colorado College's fall conference. We were backed by the Colorado Springs luminous band, Charioteer.
And we also are backed by the Colorado College faculty, administration, and staff, who you can hear in the background cheering us on.
Just to remind you, what you're about to hear is a live performance of the show. And as such, it captures some of the, I don't want to say chaos.
Chaos is the right word.
We had a great time doing it. We hope that you have a great time listening to it.
Now, what usually happens in, we begin off topic with many episodes, not all of them, begin with a kind of a monologue about a professor at Colorado College who has a strong resemblance to myself. And he's called Professor Stillman. People have often said to me, "Are you Professor Stillman?" And the answer is, yeah, kind of. And so we'll begin. We'll begin, as we do many off-topic shows, with a monologue from Professor Stillman, and then we'll go into the show proper. So here we go, as Garrison Keillor would say. All right. Professor Stillman could see them coming. The long line of minivans and SUVs as it snaked its way towards campus, heading towards the college, from California and Maine, from Denver and Detroit and DIA, from old Honolulu, San Francisco, and Ashtabula. They came down I-25, eyes peeled for the sign pointing the way towards campus, then exiting the highway, slowing down for the stoplight at the bottom of the off-ramp, making the turn, then stepping on the gas to get it up the hill at Uinta. That was where they'd catch their first glimpse of campus, of Tut's statue glinting in the sunlight in front of the library, of Palmer and Packard Hall, of Armstrong, of the football field in Warner Center, of Chauve and the green quad extending out in front of it. The car is now moving slowly, laboriously, seeming to wheeze under the weight of roof racks onto which had been crowded skis and ski poles, mountain bikes and kayaks, fishing rods, microwaves, bike helmets, hockey and lacrosse sticks, guitar amps, mini refrigerators, easels, violins and cellos, stereo speakers. Bursting from the inside with bloated duffel bags filled with heavy and light clothing, with iPads and iPods and iMacs, flat-screen televisions and PlayStations and boxes of blankets, laser printers with mittens and Ethernet cables and toothpaste, with batteries, with shower caddies and bathrobes and washcloths, with vitamins and antibacterial ointment and tweezers, cell phone chargers and webcams, calculators with rubber bands, with envelopes and pillows, sleeping bags and sleeping pills and allergy medication, with cameras and soccer balls and flutes, birth control pills, organic junk food of every description, Nutella and peanut butter, cans of Diet Coke and bongs, granola bars, instant coffee, wasabi beans from Trader Joe's and salt and vinegar chips from Whole Foods, and boxes of bottled water. Pulling into the parking lot, the students open doors and jump out and start to unpack, and then see each other and exclaim and weep and dance. Their summers have been unbelievable, bloated with exotic and unspeakable pleasures. The parents lean against the hoods of cars and watch in silence, disoriented by the high-altitude Colorado sunshine. "Can you feel it?" they ask each other. "What is it, almost 7,000 feet? They remind each other to stay hydrated, nodding. "We have made it this far," they seem to say. "We have got them to college. This much we have done for them." Ordinarily, Professor Stillman stayed as far away as possible from campus when the students arrived. But not this year. This year, some part of him wanted to witness it, needed to see the spectacle of the campus shaking itself awake. There were books to return to the library, a review to finish, syllabi to prepare, but instead of doing any of these things, Stillman sat and stared out the window, watching the families pull in and out, the elated arrivals, and the tearful goodbyes. And then there was a knock at the door. It surprised him. Armstrong Hall was mostly deserted. He realized he had turned on the light to his office. A rookie mistake. A dead giveaway. Stillman sat silently in his chair, not moving. He tried not to breathe, tried not to move his eyelids. It didn't work. A moment later, there was another knock. And the sound of a voice. Stillman, said the voice. You in there? It was Professor Sarchet, who had the office across from his. Stillman knew then he had no choice. He would have to open the door. You could fool some of the people some of the time, but it was impossible to fool Professor Sarchet. He got up from the desk. Stillman, said Professor Sarchet, shaking Stillman's hand. Good summer? Stillman didn't know how to answer this question. He tried to think back, but nothing came. Instead, what he remembered was the last day of classes, and now this, the arrival of the students. He must have done something in between, but he didn't know what. It went quickly, said Stillman, cautiously. I was in Greece, said Sarchet. Sailed the Aegean. God, it was beautiful. You have no idea. Absolutely glorious. Absolutely glorious. I don't know how anyone can say they've lived until they've been to Greece. I've never been to Greece, said Stillman. That was then what can only be described as an awkward silence descended between them. Professor Sarchet nodded, and Stillman nodded back, and for a long moment the two of them stood there in the hall, nodding in unison. Anyway, said Professor Sarchet, have a great year. Stepping back into his office, there flashed into Stillman's mind an image from earlier that morning of dropping his son Jimmy off for the first day of third grade. That weekend they'd gone to Target and bought everything he'd need, pencils and a pencil pouch, scissors, Elmer's school glue, washable crayons, hand sanitizer, and a water bottle. It was the water bottle that seemed to worry Jimmy the most. And so they practiced the night before, opening it and closing it, how to unscrew the top to put more water in. Then they put everything in the backpack so it would be ready for the morning. Jimmy said he was ready, and Stillman thought he was. But all the same, as they stood in line at the school, Stillman was overcome by a strange anxiety. Are you going to be all right? Said Stillman. It was, he knew, a bad question. The worst question. The kind of question you wanted to ask everyone, all the time. It had no answer. What do you mean, said Jimmy? Am I going to be all right? Stillman was about to explain, but then didn't. I mean, he said instead, do you want to try the water bottle again? Jimmy shook his head. No way, he said. I've got it. Are you sure? Said Stillman, in spite of himself. I mean, really, are you really sure? Dad, said little Jimmy, I can totally dominate this water bottle. And right then, the line of children began to move. The first day was underway. Stillman thought that Jimmy might turn and look, maybe wave, but he didn't. Stillman stood there anyway. He can totally dominate that water bottle, he told himself. My kid is going to be fine.
Now, you just dropped off a child at college.
I dropped off my eldest son for his first year of college day before yesterday. Yeah.
Now, not only have you dropped off a child at college, you've also been to college yourself.
Once, yes.
And that, and not to give things, not for the audience at home, that was some time ago that you entered.
Thank you, Stephen. I think I'm holding up well, though. You've been preserved, yes.
Now, how has it changed? How has the experience, say, of dropping off your son at college changed from the moment when you went to college?
Right. I started college, more than 30 years ago I started college. So it's been 32 years since I went off for my freshman year. And really thinking about it, there are two things that have really struck me as being different. One is on the airplane flight on the way home, I was extremely interested in the article in the Los Angeles Times about student debt.
Right.
It took a lot of my attention, that article, because when I graduated from college, I graduated without any debt. I went to a four-year college. It was not a cheap one, but it wasn't like it is now, where the average college graduate now graduates with $26,000 of debt. Is that right? I think that's what it said in the newspaper article. So that's something that really captured my attention.
It wasn't on your mind really at all when you went to college, and now as a parent taking a child to college, very much on your mind.
Very much on my mind. The second thing, though, that occurred to me is my son has in his pocket on his phone the entire body of human knowledge since the beginning of time. He can access that or also look at cats. So those things are both really good. And so there's this question, if you have all of human knowledge in your pocket all the time, why would you need to take a class from Steve Hayward, right? You could just, how to write well, Google it up, right? Google up how to write well, and there it is for you. So why are we doing this thing when all of human knowledge, you know, I could have it in my pen, the NSA can stream it to us through the brain chips they're going to implant.
Yeah, you think there should be an app for that.
You would think.
A Hayward app.
Right.
You know.
I can see that there would be pros and cons. Let me put it that way. Right.
So what we did for this episode of Off Topic as a way of contextualizing this discussion, a way of outlining the problem, is we talked to various people about the transformations in education in the 21st century.
Right. So the first person we talked to was Aaron Calafato, who is co-founder and artistic director of an organization called studentdebtcrisis.org, and also the author of For Profit, a solo performance piece about his time as an admissions counselor at a for-profit college. And we thought he had some really interesting things to say about the transformation, especially the financial transformation of getting a college education in the 21st century.
What we have here is essentially the entire working class, and especially young working class, but the people, the engine that drives this thing. I believe you need those folks to be productive. And I think that student debt, you know, 40 million people are in debt. We have $1 trillion across the United States, $1.2 trillion now. And what it has done literally is it has stagnated those people's ability to contribute. And then we look around and say, why aren't people buying homes? And so that's what I see it as. And I think we are in a moment of crisis because the economy depends essentially on its young workforce. It depends essentially on those people being able to contribute. And I don't think I know that we're not able to do it. And it's unsustainable and it's growing. And that's why I think it's so important and why it's such a specific crisis.
So it's what we're talking about is a national issue. We're talking really about a lost generation in a sense.
Yeah, I think so. I think there is, you know, the millennial generation in particular is sort of a lost generation. And it's the first generation to do worse off than our parents. I mean, since the Great Depression. And, you know, where our parents are going, why are you moving back into the house? You know, why am I supporting you? Why am I having to pay your loan payments? And by the way, you know, Student Debt Crisis, we're running this campaign right now called Out With Student Debt, where we're giving people the platform just to talk about their experiences and humanize it. And what I hope to do is sort of demystify and de-stereotype the idea that it's sort of this, you know, lazy college grad who doesn't want to work. These are people that are working hard. I can tell you, I'm working my butt off. You know, people are working really hard specifically just to pay this enormous debt out.
Hi, I'm Skywalling Tischler, and this is my coming out video about my student loan debt. In 2005, I graduated at the top of my class at a for-profit college, and I had $51,777 in student loan debt. As of today, my $51,777, I owe $148,251.69. People ask, what does this do to you? It tears you up. I was not allowed on my family home loan. I was denied a job because of my credit report. I was denied a checking account. I should not be determined by this piece of paper to hold me down or back.
Most people aren't trying to be rich, you know. Most people are trying to just be human and also to be to have some sort of stake in the American dream. And so it is. There's a sense of loss, and there's a sense of abandonment, and there's also a sense of distrust because, you know, a lot of us I guess this age, between 18 and 34 or 35, you know, we believed in institutions. We believed in, with skepticism, but we believed in, you know, your counselor and your and the president saying, you know, education's the most important thing. Everyone's got to go to college. And we sort of believed in that. And then when it turns out that, wait a second, this is just sort of another opportunity for a lot of people to line their pockets, that the foundation and the actual the thing itself, the core soul of what makes higher education important, we're forgetting that. And by forgetting that, I think we've forgotten this this generation of college students.
I want you to say something about the Out with Student Debt campaign that you've started. What is it about the idea of coming out, like coming out? Why are you putting it like that? Like, why do you see it in terms of, you know, out with student debt?
There's an idea of shame with it. There's right. an idea with it's not something that people talk about openly. I know for me there's always been a lot of shame with, because it symbolizes that you can't take care of yourself. What we're trying to do is say, listen, this isn't just you. You know, you're working your job, and no matter how hard you're working, you can't seem to pay this off. And what it does is, on the surface, it reflects that you're lazy, or it reflects that, you know, that your work isn't valuable, and it reflects that, you know, you can't seem to handle this system, or that you know that you're sort of you're inept. These are these sort of thoughts that I think happen in a lot of people's minds, and there's a lot of pride. I mean, people generally, I think, want to do well and want to succeed. So that's what the idea of coming out is, that it's something that a lot of people don't like to talk about. We can talk about the numbers and how big student debt has, you know, blown up to, and, you know, $1 trillion and so on and so forth. But the actual human idea of saying, listen, you know, I have this thing and it's really tough to talk about. I'm really ashamed of what it's done for me and what it's done to my family. And that even though I'm successful, I still have this great burden that really has affected my life. And so I think that was the key about it, was being human about it, being vulnerable about it, and really being transparent, I think, is the first step. And I think the coming out campaign, that was sort of the reason behind it, is because there's a lot of people who have it, but there's not a lot of people talking about it.
My name is Daniel, and I'm coming out about my student loan debt. I have about $110,000 currently in student loans, and I make a monthly payment of $1,100. That's going up to $1,400 in loans in September of 2014. I've been making these payments for the past 3 years since I graduated, and I literally haven't made a dent at all in my loans. They haven't gone down a single penny, because some of those loans have interest rates of 12%. If I didn't have these loans, I wouldn't have to worry about having no savings, having no backup plan, having no extra money for any medical emergencies. And I would be able to worry about things like contributing to the economy by investing in a house or a condo, or starting a family, or traveling the world, pursuing my master's degree, all of these things. But I can't think about those things because I have to focus on making a minimum monthly payment that is more than about 80% of my take-home pay. That leaves me barely anything for groceries and gas. And it almost reassures me that I will never be able to own anything or be able to afford anything on my own.
Wow, that's no. It's some it's a moving testimony, and it's these are people who are in serious trouble. The question it raised for us is one having to do with if student debt is a reality, if it's a necessity. In what way, then, can education be an investment? Does it still make sense? Does it make any sense to think of education as an investment?
Right. And so neither you nor I, as far as I know, are economists. But we do have on the faculty at Colorado College Kevin Rask in the Department of Economics, who's a specialist in the economics of higher education. So we tracked him down.
Yes, we corralled him into the studio and asked him that very question.
When you see some of the figures about student debt, or at least what colleges cost, so if colleges, especially some of the selectives, cost $50,000 or $55,000 a year, number one, is our students really paying that? With financial aid, with merit aid, most students aren't paying that. The average is much lower. But there is a broad spectrum of how wealthy, how certain schools, how much aid certain schools have to give you. So if you come out of school with $25,000 or $30,000 or $40,000 in debt, if you're in a low-paying profession, if you're going to go be an elementary school teacher, you need to have that, you know, you need to have your eyes open mm-hmm. In terms of what your salary is going to be. But on average, if you're talking about a $20,000, $25,000 wage difference between a college education and a high school degree, that it doesn't take many years to make up even that amount of debt. So it's a little bit about what the debt is, and it's a little bit about what your area of interest is, because the premium may be as high as $30,000 or $40,000 a year more yeah. with your college degree, and then $15,000, $20,000, $30,000 of debt. It's not that much.
Right, disappears pretty quickly when yeah. you're talking about that kind of economic differential in terms of what you're going to make with
yes,
the degree.
What you're going to make with it.
Great. So Kevin brings up, I think, a really interesting point, which is the pay differential between having a high school degree and a college degree, making the argument that you may end up with some debt, but it really is an investment that will pay off over time.
You know, I mean, I think what Kevin's saying is that when you go into college, a 17-year-old needs to know what he or she is getting into. And I think back about myself when I was 17 and the kinds of assessments that I made about the world. I mean, my ambition was to be a member of The Cure, you know, which I'm not sure that I was in that kind of position to make a realistic assessment of.
Right. So we talked to Dale Stevens, who's the founder of uncollege.org and the author of the book Hacking Your Education, who thinks that maybe the money that young people and their families are spending on college might be better spent getting some of this experience, getting a better idea, a better sense of what they should be doing, what's a realistic thing to do. You would have been fabulous in The Cure, but they had no openings. So we talked to Dale.
UnCollege is an organization that helps people become better at being self-directed learners. It came out of my frustration at school, which came out of my frustration when I was 12. When I was 12, I decided that I wanted to leave the formal schooling system and left the formal schooling system after fifth grade. And instead of going to middle school and high school, engaged in a self-directed kind of homeschooling called unschooling. So I went out and found mentors, I built businesses, I did internships. I was able to really engage with how, where, when, and what I was learning.
Right.
But despite all of that, I still went off to college. I went off to a small private liberal arts school thinking that that was going to be the way. You know, my parents had done so, my peers were doing so, and that's what folks tell you need to do if you're going to be successful in life. And found that I was really frustrated being thrown back into an environment where most people didn't know why they were there. They didn't really want to be there. And learning wasn't actually the thing that was valued. So UnCollege came out of those frustrations. 2.5 years ago, I started writing about my frustrations, hoping that some of my friends back home and perhaps my parents would have some sympathy for the challenges I was facing at college. I ended up getting a bunch of press attention, told someone I was writing a book, ended up selling that book to Penguin, and then spent a lot of the last 2 years doing research for that book, Hacking Your Education, interviewing almost 100 people who've done interesting things with their lives without relying on formal schooling. And now UnCollege runs educational programs for people who want to learn outside of school. Our flagship program is a gap year program where we help people become better and more effective learners over the course of a year.
So Stevens was unsatisfied with his college experience and so decided to get outside, get some kind of practical experience in the real world. And it's a choice that we hear about a lot. It's one that is in some way valorized by our culture, the idea of the savant tech wizard who leaves college and then becomes a billionaire.
Right, because there's this cultural idea that somehow coming to college is going to clamp down on all of your creativity, innovative ideas. It's a vision that has a certain appeal to it, especially if you're looking at a very expensive college. Yeah.
So I asked him about that question. I said, is there something about the college experience that actually stifles the entrepreneurial inventive spirit?
If you think about the you know, the cultural context that college has held over the last, you know, 60 years, it's really changed a lot, right? In the 1950s and 1960s, colleges were the place where protests to the Vietnam War started, right? There was Kansas
sure.
State, there were all, you know, Students for a Democratic Society, there were all these kinds of movements that were sort of, you know, bastions of people who were doing very radical things. It's not to say that all of those radical things were good by any means. But it's interesting to me that the bastions for places for people doing radical things have now sort of moved outside of college.
Interesting.
And if you want to do radical things and you want to start companies or start a project or start an organization, it's often easier to go outside. And that's why you see hotbeds in New York and San Francisco of all these people who are doing different things, who are starting companies, who didn't find support in college. So I don't know if it's necessarily stifling entrepreneurs, but I do think it is sort of stifling this creative rebel spirit that I think undoubtedly a lot of value has come from throughout history. So education is something that's recursive, right? It builds upon itself, I think we've sort of reached a peak in that recursion. Like there's you can't build more institutions, they can't get more elite, you can't do more research, you can't find more endowment dollars. And 50, 60 years ago, there were still folks, there were still places that were opening their very first PhD programs, right? So they were having to figure out, what is the curriculum? What are the questions that we have to ask? And now that those programs are established, there's less of that has to be done.
So this is Stephen's critique, that colleges are no longer the space of invention, the space of intellectual ferment that they once were. Calcified curriculum, moribund faculty.
You name no names.
If you're gonna be a real entrepreneur, if you're gonna really think new thoughts, do new things, make some real money, you have to leave college.
Right. So I try not to be really defensive as a college professor when I hear that. But I think that Stevens does have an interesting point, that there has been a transformation in the way organizations are academic organizations are structured. And of course, that's true from the beginning of colleges. You know, my college started off as a place for Puritan ministers to learn about sinners in the hands of an angry God. It's evolved some since then. All organizations, all institutions evolve and change. We talked to Benjamin Ginsberg, who's a professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University, who once again has some very critical arguments about the specific ways that he sees academic institutions have evolved and changed over the past just couple of decades.
When I was a young assistant professor in the 1970s, there were actually very few administrators, and for the most part, administration was undertaken by the faculty on a part-time basis, or, in the case of the most senior administrators, older faculty who no longer could bring in grant support, no longer were much interested in research. This was considered, you know, doing administration was considered an honorable way to end your academic career. So there were very, very few professional administrators. I first began to notice, and I think the data bear this out, an expansion in the administrative ranks during the 1980s into the 1990s. It was faster at some schools, slower at others. And this had a number of underlying causes. One was that more individuals began seeing administration as a full-time career. And the advent of the professional administrator was a very, very serious blow to higher education. Now, this growth of administration produces a number of very, very significant problems. One is, of course, cost. Administrators are very expensive. Not only do they make quite a bit of money, but they require staffs. Second, having armies of administrators leads to make-work activities that are expensive because they don't have that much to do. They invent things. I mean, in my book, I talk about the Committee on Traditions, which many people thought I made up until they Googled it. Lots of schools administrators have created committees on tradition to investigate forgotten college traditions that might be revived. They have to staff right. up for this, and they copied it from one another. But I would say more generally, I think this is the point that I want people to really remember. The old-fashioned administrators, faculty administrators, were like us. They were faculty members, and their vision of the university was, I think, the correct vision. That is, they believed that the purpose of the university was research and teaching, and that the buildings and all this other stuff, this was a means. You know, we had buildings in order to house classes. We had all sorts of staff in order to facilitate the process of teaching, learning, doing research. Seems obvious. But to the new model administrator, the professional administrator, what to us was the means is the end. From their perspective, university exists as a kind of corporate entity whose needs are, you know, profitability and cool buildings, and the faculty and the students are customers, and the faculty exist only to attract customers to the store. So the curriculum, the research agenda, all of this is, you know, like decoration in the store's front window. It has no higher purpose. So they confuse the ends and means of education, and in my view, are destroying the American college and the American university. So that's, you know, left to themselves, okay, so they waste money. But the problem is that when they take over the university, they subvert it and educationally pervert it.
I think really what's at issue here is how we can ensure that colleges keep education, and more specifically teaching, the focus of what we do, while still transforming and taking account of the different demands of the 21st
right.
century.
That it is not 1950 anymore.
And interestingly, Kevin Rask from CC touched on made a very similar point.
We have a lot of transition, shaking out, rethinking of our system of higher education, a broad system of higher education, in the next decade or so, both with the onslaught of the online and the technical side, but also what we as academics do.
Hmm.
I think not necessarily at a place like CC, and again, given my own bias, the sort of learning structure, what faculty job is, research versus teaching balance, all of those,
right.
I think are going to be in a significant state of change. Because I don't believe that the public anymore, with the outcry, is going to put up with too many TAs and adjuncts and when they're paying the state tuition, even the state tuitions that they have to pay.
So you see a move towards more hands-on, more direct contact between faculty and students.
Teaching again, yeah. I think you need to have it, because you know the days of needing to show your value and worth in the classroom are coming.
Is that
at
right?
At the state level, yeah.
Well, because I thought you were going to go in the other direction.
No.
I was getting really nervous. I was beginning to look for other work.
No, I mean, I've seen when I came. So I started in the early '90s, and so we're coming through grad school in the late '80s and early '90s, and even at liberal arts schools at that point was starting to see that the push for research, right?
Right. Yeah.
That really wasn't happening with my colleagues just a generation older. And then going through that, and it was always at the research institutions. The teaching was sort of secondary on the side, if it was even, you know, quality.
Yeah.
If there was even teaching going on. But you know, so now even at the questioning of that, even in liberal arts world, I think is beginning a little bit, because I maybe that pendulum shifted a little too far.
And
I like research, and there's no, you know, I don't have any issues that I love doing my work. But there's no substitute for hands-on in the class.
That was Colorado College Professor of Economics Kevin Rask. This week's topic, transformations of higher education in the 21st century. Stay with us for more of Live Off Topic.
Tell me why. this weight I'm carrying, 'cause it's getting heavy. Well, I know tonight you'll change your mind, and I hope tonight.
Welcome back to Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray.
I'm Steve Hayward.
This week's episode is a special live performance from the Celeste Theater on the Colorado College campus.
We're talking about transformations of higher education in the 21st century.
I think there are a lot of questions. I think there are a lot of possibilities. And when faced with such conundrums, when faced with such, such deep questions, you think, who to ask?
Who are you going to call?
Who are you going to call?
Who are you going to call?
Is Jill Tiefenthaler here, president of Colorado College? Jill, would you mind? Jill, welcome to Off Topic.
Glad to be here.
Well, thank you for being
here.
We'll see.
Tough questions.
Tough questions. So we have some tough questions. You took over Colorado College. This will be your second year here.
Third.
It's, the time has flown.
It has flown by.
When you're having fun.
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah. But you took over Colorado College at a time when a lot of colleges are really facing a lot of crises. And we've been talking about some of those. So let's just dive right in. This is an expensive school. People graduate from here with debt. Is it worth it?
Absolutely.
How so? How so?
Well, first of all, I mean, I appreciate all your videos and your speakers and their comments, but I really do want to remind people that what you earn is only one reason to go to college, right? There are lots of other important reasons. It really fundamentally, I know, changed my life, and I'm going to guess that's the same is true for both of you. But in addition to that, even if you just look at the economic implications, it's definitely worth it. You look at a place like CC, and yes, it is expensive. The sticker price is more than $50,000 a year. But more than half of our students are on some kind of need-based financial aid. And so the net price, of course, is much lower. And while, Kathy, you mentioned a loan amount of $26,000 a year, our loan average loan at Colorado College is $19,000 a year. And while national default rates in debt are now over 10%, our default rate last year was 0.9% at Colorado College.
Wow, that's great.
And so our graduates graduate. We have over about a 90% graduation rate, right? A lot of the debt problem that we're hearing about here has a lot to do with students who take out a lot of loans and then they don't graduate. So that premium that Kevin was talking about, you only get that if you graduate, right?
Right.
And so one of the big loan problems, if you really dive into the numbers, is a lot of people get that debt, and then they don't finish. And then they don't get that premium so that they're able to pay off that loan.
Right, right. So, but, you know, it's interesting you brought up this question of what you get from college is not just the job you get afterward. I'm reminded of the artist Alex Gray, who on his first day of art school was sitting at the opening convocation next to a senior who turned to him and said, "Are you doing the fine art or the commercial art track?" And when he said, "I'm doing fine art," the guy turned to him and said, "You better learn to pump gas." And now, of course, we know there aren't jobs for people to pump gas anymore. So here's this question.
Right.
If what are we getting here so that my child, because this is about me, that my child is gonna go out in the world and have skills for a world that I have no idea what it's going to look like. None of us have any idea
exactly
what it's going to look like.
And I think that's why the liberal arts is more relevant than it's ever been before. Because how do you train for a job that won't exist in 10 years? You're much better off learning how to learn. I mean, all of us are going to have to go on learning forever, right, in this new world, whether we take certificates online or we take more courses or we're learning on the job. We know that that's the new normal, right? We're all going to have to keep improving ourselves and learning, getting professional development. And I really believe a liberal arts education, regardless of the major, whether it's fine arts or philosophy or history or economics or biology or physics or geology, whatever it is, what we do at places like CC is we teach you, right, how to learn forever. Mm-hmm. And that means building those great liberal arts skills, how to communicate, how to get through information, how to be comfortable with ambiguity and change and be able to problem solve and that great critical thinking. And that's why if you look at what employers say they want and they're having a hard time finding in the job market, they'll list the liberal arts skills. They want analytical thinkers who are nimble and quick on their feet and willing to, you know, find that out-of-the-box solution. And many countries, while in the U.S. we've been sort of dissing the liberal arts in recent years, many countries around the world, including China and Europe, are looking at developing liberal arts colleges right now because they want that creative, innovative thinking.
Right, and we do see that there is something where people look at the liberal arts and really see that this is a huge waste of time and waste of money, and couldn't there just be an app for that? So we see that one of the things going on, Georgia Tech just announced they're going to have an all-online master's program. Right. And so it seems that there's a bifurcation that's happening in education between the MOOCs, the massive open online courses. Mm-hmm. And what we do at CC, which almost seems to me like the artisanal education, kind of craft beer. It's like, I know my students. I know when they break up with their boyfriends. Right. I know all of that stuff. I know when they don't understand something when they do. It's all there. But is that what it seems there's a battle in education between these two methods.
Yeah, I hope that there's, I mean, one of the great strengths of American higher education has always been the diversity of it, right? Where we have the most diverse system of higher education in the world. I mean, you could look at the Colorado Springs, the four institutions here, a small liberal arts college, the Air Force Academy, a regional public four-year degree, and a community college that all serve different groups of students and do it really well. The idea of moving, I mean, I think, you know, MOOCs or massively open online courses, there is a lot of potential there. I mean, it could reach students who don't have access to higher education. I think it'll supplement higher education, what many of us do in our own classes, using some of those resources. But for most of us, right, and master's courses you brought up, master's programs, I can see being mature enough and organized enough, right? But, you know, that wasn't going to help Stephen when he was when he was 17, right? Because most of us need guidance. We need mentors. We need that personal attention. And I talked to many community college presidents across the country, and they're really worried about that because they're getting the biggest push to move to online courses. And many of their students, especially their students right out of high school who haven't had maybe the best high school preparation, really need more attention. They can't just do it online. And in addition to that, you know, I talked to an employer recently about these issues, and he said to me, look, Jill, I don't want my kid in my basement for 4 years. And I don't want to hire your kid who's been in there working, you know, taking online courses. And part of what happens in that 18 to 22-year-old time period is probably the biggest personal growth that most of us experience in our life. Yeah, we're lucky enough to have that experience.
Right.
And part of that is the knowledge and the skills that we develop in the classroom. But a huge part of that is all the other things that happen, right? At CC, we have three students for every adult on campus. Wow. Imagine the kind of mentoring that doesn't even include all of our alumni and parents who reach out to our students,
right?
Our community members in Colorado Springs. So the opportunity to have mentors and also to be with each other, right?
Right.
I mean, you're with 2,000 of the smartest, most interesting people in the world for those 4 years. And, you know, there's all the other things that happen. There's the extracurriculars, the co-curriculars, athletics, parties, dating, all the things that help you to grow up to be a person. And to do that in a place where you're getting some guidance, where you can make mistakes and learn from them and have people to help you go through that developmental process. So I hope that we don't bifurcate where where we become a place where the majority is in one place and a small minority is in the other, right? Because I think that'll hurt the next generation, this millennial generation, who one of our speakers was talking about.
I think that for those of us who are academics, one of the things that the beginning of the school year, it takes us back in some way to the first time we went to college. Yeah. And I wonder, is that still the case for you? I mean, do you still get into it? Are you still it's September.
Totally. I was talking to the first years on Saturday, and I was reminiscing about my own experience. I was a farm girl. I grew up in Iowa, and I went to a small liberal arts college, and I was so homesick, but also so excited. And I think the opportunity that beginning of the year feels for all of us, I mean, it's just a new sense. And bringing all those young people and those big eyes and smiles and Just so much excitement. It's absolutely the best time of the year.
One last question. This Rask, Kevin Rask, economics professor, Colorado College. This emphasis on teaching, this teaching as a way of dealing with the unforeseen challenges. That makes sense to you?
It does. The people who are into disruptive markets, you know, how markets change, often talk about unbundling. And, for example, what happened to newspapers, right? One of the real problems that newspapers had is that what they did for their business model, right, was unbundled, right? For example, the big thing was the classifieds were pulled away from them, right. By online opportunities. Right. And that was a huge revenue source. And then ads moved away, too. So that unbundling happens. It really disrupts things. And a lot of people right now are talking about the unbundling. So we've always seen research and teaching as being very complementary. And I still think that they do because, you know, I really firmly believe that the best teachers are people who are engaged in what they do in their disciplines. But I think he's right. The pendulum has swung, right? And if that happens, then people will figure out how to unbundle the teaching without having to pay for other research.
Yeah.
So I think the finding the right balance between those two, where you have the kind of faculty that you really want in your classrooms, is the strength in the future. Because, you know, as you are as new parent, writing those checks and dropping your student off at college, you want great faculty, but you want to see them in the classroom with your student, right? And you want to be committed to working with your student. So I think we have that balance right at Colorado College.
All right. Well, thank you, Jill, for joining us.
My pleasure.
Jill Tiefenthaler, president of Colorado College.
This is Off Topic. You're listening to a special live performance of the show recorded at the Celeste Theater on the campus of Colorado College. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray.
I'm Steve Hayward.
This week's episode is a special live performance from the Celeste Theater on the Colorado College campus.
So did you, and you, not only did you go to college, Kathy, you also graduated?
Oh, well, yes, sure.
Did you go to graduation? Yes.
I actually, you know, I did not attend a single, I did not attend my high school graduation, my college graduation, or my graduation from graduate school, none of them.
That is a lot of graduations not to attend.
Not to attend, because you want every single one of those, I was already off doing the next thing. I was already on the road by the time the graduations came around. I had jumped into the next thing already.
So not valedictorian.
Not even close, baby. What about you? Were you valedictorian?
No, I wasn't valedictorian. I wasn't even on the list.
Top 10?
I was not. 10? I was like on the list of people not to not ever. To be. In French, as many of you will know, there's an expression, l'esprit de l'escalier, wit of the staircase, meaning those witty barbs that fly into your mind, the things that you should have said, that fly into your mind as you descend the spiral staircase out. I wasn't valedictorian. You weren't valedictorian. And you know who else wasn't valedictorian? Our Mellon artist in residence, Idris Goodwin, was not valedictorian. Idris, of course, a playwright, an essayist, recording artist. And so in the spirit of L'Esprit de l'Escalier, we decided to give him a second chance and to give him the opportunity to give the valedictorian address that he never got to give. So please welcome Idris Goodwin.
I graduated college in 2000. I was bleary-eyed, full of water weight, wielding a degree in something I barely understood. Our commencement was pretty underwhelming. You'd think a liberal arts college in downtown Chicago, with a focus on the creative, could have landed somebody we could all look up to. You know, like an actor. My friends, who attended the visual arts college down the street, told me that they landed Ed Harris, who was not a visual artist, but played one in a movie once. Our commencement speaker was some guy who worked at the college. I think he was the bursar or something. No offense. But this ain't about him. This is about the other guy, the guy who went on after him, a fellow student, a scrawny little guy who sidled up to the mic and proceeded to blow us all away. He was clever and insightful, and though he'd never been in any movies, he was a star that morning. "Who is that?" I whispered to Goodman, the alphabetically ordered girl sitting next to me. "He's valedictorian," she answered. "What the hell is that?" And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, wait, Idris, you were 21 years old, and you didn't know what a valedictorian was? It's true. And the reason I didn't know from valedictorian, I was never in danger of becoming one. I was a very good college student, but not great. I was efficient, but not memorable. I was kind of like couscous. No offense. So like everyone else, I'm laughing and I'm leaning forward in my seat and I'm watching the valedictorian kill. But gradually, I started to feel a certain kind of way. You know that way when you're kind of pissed that things are going so well for someone else? I'm just being honest here. It hit me. I didn't know I could have done that. I mean, nobody told me about this valedictorian business. Had I known, this whole time I was competing for a killer speaking slot at the commencement, I would have done way better. I would have shut off the GoldenEye and the Wu-Tang, kicked all those random people sleeping on my couch off of my couch, and, you know, worked harder, I guess. See, the ship had passed me by because I was dancing on the beach. And in some sick twist, that bleary-eyed, bloated young man will go on to someday teach at a liberal arts college. I'm talking about me. I work here in the theater and dance department where we are all about the imagination. All day we make forts and dress up in costumes and talk in funny voices and throw things at each other. And sometimes we put on plays and dance recitals. So let's, we the assembled, play make-believe together. Yes?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Now let's pretend I am not 35. Let's pretend I'm 21. And let's pretend you're my fellow students and we're at commencement. And let's pretend that I am your valedictorian. And let's pretend that Ed Harris has just left the stage and creeped us all out. And I have just been called up and I reach into my pocket and I remove a speech. Imagine me saying something funny, something with some edge, something offensive, but in a satirical way. Then I get personal. Then I get political. Maybe I rap a little bit. Do a little call and response, a little throw your hands in the air and all that good stuff. Then I bring it back to the poignant. I thank my family. I thank God. I thank the institution. And I mean it. And then I walk off the stage, knowing that I took all y'all through a range of emotions and inspired every single last one of you. But let's keep it 100. 2000 me, pre-Bush, pre-Terror Alert, pre-iPhone me, with his post-college dread and his Dennis Rodman blonde bleached head. He was no Ed Harris. He was not even Ed Harris's understudy. The valedictorian whose name I don't remember, I don't remember exactly what he said, but I remember the feeling he evoked. Like I wanted to wake up at the top of my freshman year and realize my 4 years had in fact been a dream and I get to do it all again. And that is not a good feeling. But that is not my message to you today. This is not a valedictorian speech, and I am not here to drop one piece of advice in your lap. Instead, I would prefer to do this. Professors, just the professors. All professors in the house, say ho. Say ho. Administrative staff, all administrative staff, say yeah. Say yeah. Now everybody throw your hands in the air and wave them like you just don't care. And if on the first day you are quite prepared, let me hear you say, oh yeah. Oh yeah. And it don't stop, and it don't quit, and it don't stop, and it don't stop.
That was Idris Goodwin, professor of theater and dance at Colorado College, recorded at our live performance of Off Topic in the Celeste Theater at Colorado College.
And that brings us to the end of the episode. Kathy, what did you learn?
I learned that I'm going to have a huge debt to pay back for years and years to come for my children's college education, but it's going to be worth it.
Absolutely. We want to thank Charioteer, who was our backup band for our live performance. You can find their music on iTunes, on Spotify, anywhere you look on that internet.
Off Topic is recorded at is usually recorded at the Tim Gill Center for Public Media, a division of Rocky Mountain PBS in Colorado Springs, Colorado, in association with KRCC. Off Topic is produced by Craig Richardson and Jake Brownell. Our interns are Wes Brandt and Leeds Mellencrot Reese.
For more information or to listen to any of these episodes, you can find us online at offtopicradio.org. I'm Steve Hayward.
I'm Kathy Jaffray.
And until next week, stay off topic.
Run, the jackals have won. You're turning us over. After so many years of being in love, the pictures of us still hang on the wall in the quiet hall. Lush, the wind reaches us and shaking the brush, it's lifting the dust as if to say, he belongs to the ages, now he's gone. Crush these illusions of love that are breaking us apart.